The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Gary Kramer. I'm a freelance writer for the Philadelphia City Paper, the Philadelphia Gay News, among other publications. And whenever you mention the name John Sayles to people, they have one of two responses. Either it's, I love his films, and then they name a favorite. For the record, Mine or Baby, It's You and Men with Guns. The other response is, he's really tall. His scripts are famous. Early in his career, Sayles wrote B-movies like Piranha and Alligator to earn cash to make films like Return of the Secaucus 7 and Liana. Later in his career, he earned Oscar nominations for his original screenplays of Passion Fish and Lone Star. But what many fans don't realize is that he was the first, if not foremost, a novelist and short story author. His books, The Pride of the Bimbos and Union Dues, were published in 1975 and 1977, respectively. The latter, a National Book Award finalist, was published a year before he penned his first paid screenplay and 2 years before he directed his first film. Alas, Sayles was too busy making movies to publish another novel until 1991, Los Gusanos. While he continued to direct and pen screenplays and author a few short story collections since then, Sayles has finally produced A Moment in the Sun, a doozy of a novel. And let me tell you, this 968-page book is worth its weight. I mean, the weight. It's worth the weight. As in Sayles' best films, and I'm thinking of Lone Star and City of Hope, among others, A Moment in the Sun features multiple narrative strands involving a rich assortment of crafty characters, each undergoing an initiation of sorts. Set in 1897, Sayles introduces readers to a Yukon gold rusher, a pair of African-American soldiers, Southern politicians, and members of a Filipino secret brotherhood, among other memorable characters. The storylines include the U.S. Maine catastrophe off the coast of Cuba and the colonization of the Philippines. The book addresses themes and topics Sayles has depicted throughout his work, ranging from greed and racism to family dynamics and politics. As always, it is his shrewd observation of human nature, his keen ear for dialogue, and his wry, sharp wit that engages readers. He is also, as one has come to expect, a visual storyteller. In Moment in the Sun, episodes as diverse as a boxing match or a haircut are vividly and viscerally rendered. It is always an occasion when Sayles takes a break from working behind the camera to share his writing with his fans. And this is what brings him here tonight. Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. John Sayles.
Hey, everybody. So since Gary told you what the book's about and when it's set, I'm going to read a chapter that's very early in the book, and it's the first time you meet this character. It's 1897, and there weren't too many ways to get rich back then. Gold fever. Hod is the first on deck to see smoke. That must be it, he says, pointing ahead to where the mountains rise up and pinch together to close off the channel. Dae. There is a rush then, stampeders running to the fore and jostling for position, climbing onto the bales of cargo lashed to the deck to see over the crush, herding at a rumor, as they have since the Utopia pulled away from the cheering throngs in Seattle, panicked that someone else might get there first. Store clerks and farmers, teamsters and railroad hands, failed proprietors and adventurous college boys and scheming hucksters, and not a few fellow refugees from underground. Hod has done every donkey job to be had in a mine, timbering, mucking ore with a shovel and cart, laying track, single-jacking chute holes with a hand auger. He knows how to look for colors in a riverbank, knows what is likely worth the sweat of digging out and what isn't. But the look in the eyes of the men crowding him up the gangplank, the press of the hungry, gold-struck mass of them, 5 days jammed shoulder to shoulder at the rail of the steamer, dodging hot cinders from the stack, half of them sick and feeding the fish or groaning below in their bunks as the other half watch the islands slide by and share rumors and warnings about a land none have ever set foot on, he understands that it will be luck and not skill that brings fortune in the north, though skill might keep you alive through the winter. Store clerk out of Missouri, wouldn't know a mine shaft from a hole in the ground, wanders off the trail to relieve himself, stubs his toe on a nugget big as a turkey egg. You pay gold dust for whatever you need up there. Won't take no paper money or stamped coin. Every night at closing, they sweep the barroom floors. There's $20, $30 in gold they sift out of the sawdust. Canadian Mounties, sitting up at the top of the pass, got a weigh station. It's a full ton of provisions, what they think should stand you for a year or no dice. Couple ounces shy, them red-jacketed sons of bitches will turn you back. The thing is, brother, if you can hit it and hold on to it, you float up into a whole nother world. Anytime you pass an opera house west of the Rockies, the name on it belongs to another clueless pilgrim which stumbled on a jackpot. This Yukon is the last place on earth. The game ain't been rigged yet. If the game isn't rigged in Dyea, it is not for lack of trying. There is no dock at the mouth of the river, greenhorns shouting in protest as their provisions are dumped roughly onto lighters from the anchored steamer, shouting more as they leap or are shoved down from the deck to ferry in with the goods, and shouting still to see them hurled from the lighters onto the mud flats that lead back to the raw little camp, deckhands heaving sacks and crates and bundles with no regard for ownership or fragility, and then every man for himself to haul his scattered outfit to higher ground before the seawater can ruin it. $50, I give you a hand with that, says a rum-reeking local with tobacco stain in his beard. I heard it was 20, Hod with his arms full, one hand pressed to cover a tear in a sack of flour. Outgoing tide, it's 20. When she's rolling in like this, the local grins, spits red juice onto the wet stones. Well, it sort of follows the law of supply and demand. Hod takes a moment too long to consider and loses the porter to a huffing Swede who offers 55. Left to his own, he hustles back and forth to build a small mountain of his food and gear on a hummock by a fresh-cut tree stump, crashing into other burden stampeders in the mad scramble, gulls wheeling noisily overhead in the darkening sky, little channel waves licking his boots on the last trip, then three dry steps before he collapses exhausted on his pile. When he gets his breath back, Hod sits up to see where he's landed. There are eagles, not so noble-looking as the ones that spread their wings on the coins and bills of the nation, eagles skulking on the riverbank, eagles thick in the trees back from the mudflats. He has never seen a live one before. They'll get into your sow belly. You leave it out in the open, says the leathery one-eyed Indian who squats by his load. I don't plan to. Better get a move on then. That tide don't stay where it is. The man introduces himself as Joe Raven and is something called a Tlinkit, and there is no bargaining with him. 12 cents a pound. Healy and Wilson charge you twice that. Be 250 to pack the whole mess to the base of the pass. We leave at first light. It is already late in the season. No time to waste lugging supplies piecemeal from camp to camp when the lakes are near freezing and the gold fields will soon be picked over. All around them, Indians and the scruffy-bearded local white men are auctioning their services off to the highest bidder. One stampeder runs frantically from group to group, shouting numbers, looking like he'll pop if he's not the first to get his stake off the beach. Well, that's about all the money I got, says Hod. The Tlinkit winks his good eye and begins to pile Hod's goods onto a runnerless sledge. Hauling this much grub, you won't starve right away. He tosses a stone at an eagle sidling close, and it flaps off a few yards, croaking with annoyance, before settling onto the flats again. Eat on a dead dog, eat the eyes out of spawn fish, Pick through horse shit if it's fresh. Lazy bastards. Joe Raven winks his single eye again. Just like us Tlinkets. The Indian wakes him well before first light. Best get on the trail, he says, before it jams up with people. Hod rises stiffly. The night spent sleeping and fits out with his goods. Laughter and cursing and a few gunshots drifting over from the jumble of raw wood shanties and smoke-grimed tents that have spread, scabies-like, a few hundred yards in from the riverbank. Any chance for breakfast in town? Well, the less you have to do with that mess, says Joe Raven, the better off you be. As they head out, there are eagles still, eagles filling the trees, sleeping. The 8 miles from Dyea to Canyon City is relatively flat, but rough enough. Hod's outfit loaded on the backs of Joe's brothers and wives and cousins and grinning little nephews, a sly-eyed bunch who break out a greasy deck of cards whenever they pause to rest or to let Hod catch up. Fortunes, or at least the day's wages, pass back and forth, which each with much ribbing in a language he can't catch the rhythm of. Hod struggles along with his own unbalanced load, clambering over felled trees and jagged boulders bigger than any he's ever seen, saving $10 and raising a crop of angry blisters on his feet as the trail winds through a narrow canyon, skirting the river, then wandering away from it. Boots appear a tad big for you, says Joe Raven. The way he has to cock his head to focus the one eye on you, Hod can't tell if the Indian is mocking him or not. Might be. He is trying not to limp, trying desperately to keep up. Don't worry. By tomorrow, your feet will swell up to fill 'em. Yeah. Canyon City is only another junk heap of tents and baggage near a waterfall. Hod forks over 2 fresh minted silver dollars for hot biscuits and a fried egg served on a plate not completely scraped clean of the last man's lunch, while the Indians sit on their loads outside and chew on dried moose, taking up the cards again. Gamblinest sons of bitches I ever seen, says a grizzled packer sitting by him on the bench in the grub tent. Worse than Chinamen. I'm paying 12 cents a pound, says Hod. The coffee is bitter, but hot off the stovetop. Is that fair? The packer looks him over, and Hod flushes, aware of just how new all his clothes are. What's fair is whatever one fella is willing to pay and another is willing to do the job for at the moment, says the man, biscuit crumbs clinging to his stubble. 3 months ago, that egg cost you $5. Just a matter of what you want and how bad you want it. After Canyon City, the trail starts to rise, Hod lagging further behind the Tlinkets and thinking seriously about what he might dump and come back for later. There are discarded goods marking both sides of the path, things people have decided they can survive without in the wilderness beyond, some with price tags still attached. We maybe pick these up on the way back, says Joe Raven, lagging to check on Hod's progress. Sell them to the next boatload of greenhorns that come in. A small, legless piano lays in the crook of a bend in the trail, and Hod can't resist stopping to toe a couple of muffled, forlorn notes with his boot. Man could haul that over as far as Dawson and play it. Be worth its weight in gold, says Joe, and then is gone up the trail. The light begins to fade, and the Indians pull far ahead. Whenever Hod thinks he's caught up, he finds only another group of trudging pilgrims who report not to have seen them. He staggers on, over and around the deadfall, searching for footprints in the early snow. I'm a fool and a tenderfoot, he thinks, heart sinking. They've stolen it all, and I'll be the laugh of the North Country. It is dark and steep and slippery, his pack rubbing the skin off his back and his feet screaming with every step, when he stumbles into the lot of them, smoking and laughing in a lantern-lit circle around the dog-eared cards. Another mile up to sheep camp, mutters Joe Raven, barely looking up from the game. Gonna blow heavy tonight, so we best skedaddle. If he takes his load off for a moment, Hod will never be able to catch his breath and hoist it again. Just let me take a moment here, says Hod, holding onto a sapling to keep himself from slatting back down the incline while the Indians gather the rest of his outfit onto their backs. You're doing pretty good for a chichaco, Joe tells him, adjusting the deer hide tump line across his forehead. We had one, his heart give out right about this section. Had to pack him back to Dyea, sell his goods to raise the passage home. Somewhere called Iowa, they said his body went. The night wind catches them halfway up to sheep camp. And when the sharper at the entrance asks Hod for $2 to collapse, still dressed, onto a carpet of spruce boughs covered with canvas in a flapping tent shared with a dozen other men, he hands it over without comment. In his sleep, Hod walks 10 miles uphill and with a load on his back. We take you to the stairs, but we don't climb, says Joe Raven the next morning, as they dump his goods next to 100 other piles in the little flat area at the bottom of the big slope. Too many fresh suckers come in into Dyea every day to bother with this mess. The last of the tall spruce and alder dealt out yesterday evening. Only a handful of wind-stunted dwarf trees left along the trek from sheep camp to the stairs. And now, nothing but a wall of rock and snowfield faces them, near vertical, all the way up to the summit. There is a black line of pack-hauling pilgrims already crawling up the steps chopped into the ice. And here in the flat, an ever-growing mob of adventurers crowded around a pair of freightage scales to weigh their outfits before starting the climb. Going to take you a couple days, maybe 20 trips, says Joe Raven, counting Hod's money. When I take a load up, what's to keep folks from stealing the rest of my outfit? The Tlingit winks. Anything you steal down here, you still got to carry it up. But whatever I leave at the top while I'm hauling the next load up, you white fellas don't much trust each other, do you? The Indian grins, then rousts his tribe of relatives with a whistle. When Hod puts his outfit on the balance, it is scant 40 pounds. Sell you 4 sacks of cornmeal, $20, says one sharper, loitering by the scales. Sell you this here case of canned goods, beans and peas, for 15, says another. I got these rocks here, says a third. You roll them in your bedding, slipping in with your flour and soda. Mounties won't take no notice. Good, clean rocks, 10 cents a pound. You ain't that short, buddy, says another man, a stampeder from the look of him. Pale yellow stubble on his face and pale eyes, one blue, one green, and pale skin made raw from the weather. You can pick up twice that weight from what's been cast away on the trip up. He says his name is Whitey, just Whitey, and that he's from Missouri and he's been waiting here since yesterday, searching for a face he can trust. You deal with this Chilcoot, he says, is you always got to have one man minding the store while the other carries the next lot up, then you switch off. Simple mathematics. Whitey shows Hod his own pile, the same goods bought for the same double prices from the same outfitters in Seattle. One load comes from your pile, then the next from mine. It don't matter who carries what. We both do the same amount of work and both get to spell ourselves at the top while the other climbs. It gets dark. One of us stays up there with what we've carried and the other down here with what's left. We'll get her done in half the time. Won't be wore out for the rest of it. It sounds good enough to Hod. They help each other load up, making packs with rope and canvas and tying on near 70 pounds apiece for the first trip. Now, no matter how weary you get, don't step out of line to rest once you're on them golden stairs, says Whitey, as they nudge their way into the crowd of men at the base of the footpath. Takes a good long spell to squeeze back in. They start up, Whitey climbing a half dozen men above Hod. The blasting cold air and the hazardous footing and the weight on Hod's back drives all thought away. His whole life tunneling down to the bend of the knees of the man in front of him, left, now right, now left, thigh muscles nodding as he follows in step, keeping count at first, step after slippery step, then giving up when the idea of the thousands more ahead proves unbearable. The first thing left by the stairs is a huge cook pot. Iron rusted a different color on its uphill side that looks to have been there for some while. Then wooden boxes and crates, dozens of them, and who has the energy to stop and look inside as the wind cuts sharp across the face of the slope? And next, it is men littering the sides of the lines of climbers, some bent over with exhaustion or waiting for a moment's gap to rejoin the file, others splayed out on the mountain face with their heels dug in to keep them from sliding, helpless as tipped turtles with their pack harnesses up around their necks, weeping. This is where you earn it. Of course, it is still a gamble, gathering all his life's toil into one stake and chasing after gold. But it isn't a weak man's play, like laying it on poker or faro, hoping the numbers will smile on you and shun the rest at the table. The weak ones will falter here. Only those with the strength, with the will to pull their burdens over this mountain and then down 500 miles of raging, ice-choked river will even get to roll their dice in the Yukon. For the first time since he was herded onto the steamer with the rest of the Stampeders, Hod feels truly hopeful, odds that are long getting shorter with each busted, despairing pilgrim he passes. I will stomp this mountain flat, he thinks, leaning into the slope and forcing himself not to look up. No use worrying about how far it still is. Afternoon sun and the friction of boots slick the icy gouges, stairs only in a manner of speaking. And though there is a rope you can grab onto, it is ice-crusted and unreliable, the great mass above and behind jerking it one way or the other. His legs burn, then ache, then go to numb rubber, and then suddenly it is over, teetering sideways to flop in the snow next to Whitey and a half dozen others. Whitey is laughing and wheezing, pointing at the unbroken line of men and, yes, a few women that stretches all the way down Long Hill, ending in a black pool of those waiting to start the climb. You figure if God got a sense of humor, he says, this is a real knee slapper. They pick a spot in the middle of the hundreds of caches to unload their packs, then walk together to the edge of the ridge. You looking a mite leg weary, buddy? Says Whitey, a shining new shovel slung over his shoulders. I'd better make the next run. There are two chutes running down the slope, icy sides polished with the traffic of bodies. Some men have made crude sleds, and some just lay on their backs and draw their knees up to their chest, feet pointing downhill, wait a 10 count, holler, and then let fly, hoping not to stack up if somebody catches a boot heel. You got to be shitting me, says Hod. Whitey smiles and sits down on the blade of the shovel, the handle pointing out between his knees. You give me a nudge and then go rest up. We can get us in another couple trips before it's dark. Whitey is at the bottom in the time it takes Hod to pull his mittens off. At their pile, Hod pulls out the blankets rolled at the top of his pack to make a nest and even sleeps a little, his legs twitching and complaining all the while, then wakes and gets up to stretch. Men huddle around a little fire, burning a smashed packing crate, smoking pipes, and telling tales of gold. Hod lays his couple stale biscuits close to the flame till they are blistered on both sides. They are only yards away from the line of Stampeders waiting for the final weigh-in and tariff, a red-jacketed Mountie with a Winchester standing guard in front of a little white tent with a Union Jack flapping over it, his fellows weighing and thoroughly examining the outfits. Nobody is getting past them hauling stones. They count your damn socks, grumbles a man by the fire. Bunch of mother hens. Man wants to go freeze to death, starve to death, whatever, whilst he's searching for his bonanza. That ought to be his lookout, says another. The soldiers are noting it all, checking off on their lists the picks and shovels, the cooking pots and utensils, the tents and blankets and lamps and oil and flour and soda and bacon and beans and sets of long underwear, everything down to the shoelaces. If there are firearms, they note those too, writing down the make and model, the caliber and amount of ammunition. St. Peter made this much fuss at the Golden Gate, barks the sourdough whose goods they are poring over. There wouldn't be a saint in heaven. It is nearly evening when Whitey reaches the summit again. He has Hod's tent and promises to set it up while Hod makes the last climb. Be a place to get out of the weather when you get here. And then you'll go back down? I got mine all fixed at the bottom. I tell you, I feel sorry for these poor folks trying to go it alone. The shovel deal makes him nervous, so Hod chooses to run the chute on his back, folding his arms in the way Whitey shows him, like a dead man in a coffin. He has to wiggle a little to get going, then picks up speed, tucking his chin to his chest and not realizing he is screaming with exhilaration till he is halfway down and the air whipping tears into his eyes, rolling sideways a bit like he might fly out of the groove, but then sliding to a long stop at the bottom and slammed by the whooping pilgrim behind him. He loads his pack as fast as he can and shoves his way back into the line, but there is no speed to be gained on the stairs, and after 2 hours of trudging, the light dies. The climbers close up then, each with a hand resting on the small of the back of the man ahead, moving slower, digging in at every foothold. There are a few long halts, somebody fallen most likely, but no telling, just minutes of bracing still against the night wind, and then creeping upward again. There is a cot and a tin cup of lukewarm coffee waiting in the tent Whitey has set up at the top. It makes Hod near want to cry. "You're not sliding down in the dark, are you?" "Don't see why the hell not," says Whitey, tying the straps of his hat tight under his chin. "I ain't gonna fall, am I?" It is possible only to do 3 trips each day, the men trading few words in passing, eager to use every bit of light. Hod hates the stairs more with every grinding ascent, but as the days pass, their pile of goods at the top grows larger than the one at the bottom, and he uses his rest time to learn what he can about what lays ahead. "It's an easy 6 miles down to Happy Camp on the Canadian side, then half of that to the edge of Lake Lindeman on the headwaters of the Yukon," they say. "Ain't a straight tree left standing for miles around that lake camp," what they say. "Whole damn forest been felled and whipsawed into planks and gone floating down the river. Been so many lost in them White Horse Rapids," they say. "Mounties make you hire a pilot and you run past them. Another goddamn robbery. You a good swimmer? Hell, I'd drown in a bathtub." "Well, it's lucky you ain't never been in one." Laughter, then. They are chasing the same nuggets and know there are not nearly enough for all of them, no matter how big the country, but have been drawn together, at least for the moment, by hardship. Not too many spend the night on the summit, a pair of Mounties left to make sure nobody sneaks across, and even with most of the caches unattended, Hod hasn't witnessed any notable thievery. He and Whitey might be playing it too safe, he thinks. Both of them could be hauling all day long and double their chances of getting down the river before the freeze. "I've been wondering the same," says Whitey as he staggers up with the morning haul. "I met a fella says he's waiting up here for his partner to come before he crosses over. Let me go find him and we'll work something out. Couple dollars to look after our tent and I'll be right on your tail. I'd sure like to see the last of this damn Chilkoot." Hod sees it is mostly Whitey's outfit left when he gets to the bottom. He loads up with canned goods, rigging a pair of lanterns to hang over the back that rattle some when he moves, but won't fall off. His legs have hardened to the trail. He wonders how to ask Whitey to partner with him on the other side and how that will be. No telling what a man is like till you've gone down the long road with him. Whitey brings up whiskey with every load he hauls, and there is a sentry line of empty pint bottles outside each of the tents, but he has never passed out when Hod gets to the top, has never missed a turn on the stairs. Hod has relied on other men in the mines, depended on his brother diggers for his life on occasion, but partnering with no one the boss and no one the worker, it will be half the treasure if they make a strike, of course, but also half the work. This north country is so big, so empty, the whole flocking mass of them, thousands of stampeders, only a aimless scattering of piss ants in its white immensity. A man alone, tiny black dot stumbling over the treacherous surface, can disappear without a trace. "Young fellas like you and me," Whitey likes to say, "there ain't no limit to what we could do in times like these. Got a steady man in the White House who understands there are fortunes to be made if the government will just step out of the way and let us at them. The world," Whitey likes to say, "is our oyster." The tent at the summit is gone. The tent is gone, and the goods, all of them, the picks and shovels and lamp oil and bacon and beans and flour and the Mackinaw suit and mucklucks and the $35 China dog coat he bought in Seattle gone with it, only the half dozen empty whiskey bottles marking the spot where his catch had been. None of the men around, busy with their own tortured passage, have noticed a thing. "You mind your stake, brother, and I'll mind mine," they tell him. His outfit is gone, and no matter how quickly he slides to the bottom, he knows he will find the rest of it gone too. He's been taken. Nobody pays attention to his cursing. Nobody watches as he circles back again and again to the spot where the tent had been set up, kicking the bottles across the snow. There is gold in the country beyond the pass, and one stampede or less in the trace can only be good news. Hod wanders the summit for an hour, howling, the other adventurers turning away from him, embarrassed to be on the same mountain with such an idiot greenhorn, before he remembers he is still strapped to the final load. He slips his tump line and lets it thud to the snow, glass in one of the lanterns breaking, and seeks the counsel of the Northwest Mounted Police.
Thanks.
So I'm going to open this up to questions. And if you have a question, there's people with microphones, and just come out, and either they'll come to you or you'll come to them. Anybody have a question? Yes.
Two questions, actually. I was just wondering, because you're also a cinematographer, if you actually visualize these things as you're writing, you know, you must have a very good visual concepts too, mm-hmm. dealing with the camera, and perhaps even envisioning characters, actors' faces. I don't know, but I'm just curious.
Yeah, you know, the advantage of writing something that's set anytime kind of after the Civil War is there were actually photographs. Some of A Moment in the Sun takes place in the Philippines during the Philippine-American War, which cameras had been around for a long time, but that's the first war where the soldiers actually had cameras. There was a very cheap Kodak camera and some rip-off versions that cost a dollar, and then film didn't cost that much. So there's a lot of photographs of this time, a lot of photographs of this incident. You can see this thin line of guys going up the golden stairway, you know, to the top to get to the Canadian border and the, you know, the way station and the checkpoint. So some of it is actually having the graphic evidence there of what things looked like. When that's not there, I've tried to go to those places, and I took a trip to the Philippines expressly to go to some of the places that I had written about and read about but never seen with my own eye. And every once in a while, the volcano's on that side of the Dagupan Railway, not that side, and you know, and you see what the trees look like and those kind of things. So yeah, visual is a big part of it. As far as the faces, I don't know exactly what they look like. I know this character becomes a boxer during the thing and gets his nose broken, so I know he's Caucasian and has a broken nose. A couple of the other characters, you know what race they are, but I don't usually picture them. I also don't do that when I'm writing a screenplay. I try actually to avoid thinking of what actor will play the part, because so often it's Spencer Tracy and he's dead. But also, if it's somebody who's alive, you're not, even if you know them, you're not necessarily going to get them.
Yeah, great. One last silly question. Mm-hmm. I have to ask it. Did the guy ever make it off the island?
You know, this is about the end of our movie Limbo. And the first thing I knew about that movie was the ending of it, which is that so many movies that we see, the end is, does the hero get shot or not? Or does he recover from getting shot or not? And I wanted to make a movie that was about something other than that. And so I said, well, we're not going to know whether they live or die, but we're going to know some other things about them. I asked the cast whether the family survives or not, and the two women said, we're dead meat, and the two guys said, I think we'll work it out. So it really is up to you. Yes, in the middle.
What is the shoot that these people are
doing? It's both, but you can only go quickly down. This was a very precipitous face, a snowfield, and they chopped, you know, when it got icy, they chopped steps into it, and then people walked up it. Well, the quickest way down was to slide down, and the heat of their bodies and just the amount of people going down made these two, and you can see them in the pictures, these two chutes, and kind of like a water slide or something, except there's no water, it's just ice. Guys would just take a little rest at the top and then point their feet down, and what had taken them 2.5 hours, 3 hours sometimes in the dark or bad weather to get up, they would be down in less than 3 minutes. So it was kind of like an e-ticket at Disneyland, but you know, you didn't have to pay for it. Yes. What drew me to this topic? You know, I my last novel, Los Gusanos, is about the long dance between Cuba and the United States. It was set in 1981, and in doing research for that, I did some research about the Spanish-American War, and I stumbled across these mentions of the Philippine-American War. And I said, how can I be 37 years old and I've never heard of the Philippine-American War? And I asked some Filipino and Philippine-American friends, what do you know about this? And they said, well, we know about it, but it's not taught in our schools in the Philippines. I said, whoa, this is a war where probably 1 million people died, if you count the disease and, you know, after effects of war. How does that get erased? How does that get forgotten? And so I got suspicious and then interested in that. And then at the same time that was going on, stuff was going on in this country. That basically the last nail in the coffin of Reconstruction was happening. So North Carolina, the last state of the Confederacy to take away the right of black people to vote, black men to vote. Women couldn't vote at all back then. But, you know, and that happened, you know, in a very calculated way. Between 1875, when the Yankees marched out of the South, and 1900, and the last stand was in Wilmington, North Carolina. And these two things were connected by racism and a way that Americans were thinking of themselves. And I thought, okay, this is a great story to send a bunch of characters through. Yes?
Please wait for the microphone.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I've really appreciated about your other books is your incredible ear for dialogue.
Mm-hmm.
But all of those books, as far as I can remember, are contemporary in one way or another. Mm-hmm. So how, when you're writing a historical book like this, what kind of research do you do to get the words right? And how much of it is purely imagined and taken from other books, or just what's the substitute for your own ear for dialogue?
Yeah, it's a combination of things. You read fiction of the time. Some writers are good writers, but they're terrible at dialogue. Mark Twain was good at dialect. Other people writing, it just seems like awful vaudeville stuff. So you really pay attention to who's writing fiction at that time, or even nonfiction, where they try to characterize people. I read a lot of diaries. And people usually express themselves a little better in print than they do in speech, but you get some rhythms from it. You characterize it by, you know, where is this person from? Are they educated? Can they read? Can they not read? And then sometimes it really is a convention, which I have Filipino characters, quite a few in this book, and the ilustrados, the educated ones, would be speaking with each other in Spanish. And I can speak Spanish, and so there, I write it in Spanish first, and then I look and I say, well, how would I translate that that's not too stodgy back into English? So you get a feeling of their education, at least, and their wit. And then other characters who were uneducated would be speaking one of at least a half dozen Filipino languages, Tagalog or Sambal or Pampangano or whatever, but I have to have them speak in English, and then I keep it as simple as possible, keeping in mind where they're from and whether they're educated or not. So it is a combination of things. And then you also have to factor in that in the case of prospectors, they never really did say, well, I'll be hornswoggled. The words that people would use today existed back then, and you throw those in where they're appropriate. And then it's situational. In those days, you did not speak crudely in front of a woman no matter who you were. And so if there's a woman present, the guys are going to up their ante a little with their language. So each situation is individual, but you do a lot. And then once you find the voice of somebody,
in a book this long, you have to go back and check, you know, and say, so, you know, how erudite or not was this guy? What was the rhythm of his speech? When I write a screenplay, I basically play every character. I was an actor before I was anything else, and I'll read it out loud. And part of that is to find the right rhythm for a character, but part of it is so everybody doesn't talk the same way. You know, I think part of who you are is how you express yourself. You know, there's a choice involved, or there is history involved, and that's why you speak that way. On the aisle, back there.
Thank you. Mr. Sales, a great honor, sir. You came up through with a certain amount of contemporaries and independent film, and some of your contemporaries kind of chose more experimental stories and methods of, you know, of capturing those stories. And even though some of your subject matters are somewhat unconventional, the way you develop stories, the way you develop characters is more conventional. I mean, stuff that could be made by Hollywood for like 10 times the budget or more. Mm-hmm. What did you consciously make this sort of decision? Was it a, you know, did you want to just tell straight ahead stories or?
It really depends on which story it is. So, Mate One is has a certain rhythm because of where it is. The storytelling is fairly straightforward narrative in both Mate One and Eight Men Out, but it has a very different rhythm. One set in 1919, one set in 1920, but one set in West Virginia, and in a very rural place. And it has it's a dissolved movie. There's not a lot of fast cutting. It has a seasonal rhythm to it. And the other is set in Chicago at the dawn of the jazz age. And I showed all the actors a Jimmy Cagney movie where everybody talks really fast before it. So each movie you find, you know, there's some of my movies where there are characters who are purely Greek choruses or metaphoric or are not. They may be framing devices, but that worked for that particular movie. You know, Brother from Another Planet, there's a guy from another planet. And then he lands in Harlem, and then the rest of the movie is actually pretty straightforward drama. So some of it is that I think my main interest always is in telling stories about people, not in starting with a form, or I'm not interested in, this time I'm going to tell a story using a 35 millimeter lens and never change it. Or I'm going to stretch the envelope of how you tell a story. It really starts with my interest in the people. And to the thing that I think stretches the average audience the most about our films is that they're very complex stories. And that's unusual, you know, in any movie still, you know, whether it's avant-garde or whatever, they're complex stories. And the characters are complex. And so you actually sometimes, they disappoint you sometimes as a, just like your friends who you might love can disappoint you. Sometimes people are saying, oh, this is the part in the movie where a man's got to do what a man's going to do, like in Mate One. And in fact, the guy's a pacifist and he doesn't pick up a gun. You know, and that was surprising to people. So I do think that they're classic filmmaking in one way, but they're unusual in another way, in that what movies have always done, and Moment in the Sun takes place at the dawn of movie making, and already they're starting to separate things into white hats and black hats. That's what movies do very, very well. They polarize people, simple good, simple evil. You know, there's Spider-Man, there's the guy in the black suit, let him duke it out. And I'm doing a thing that's actually a little harder to do in movies, I think, which is get a general audience to enter something where the characters are complex and the situation is complex, and you come away, like in Limbo, saying, Jesus, did they get killed or not? What just went on? Yes, we're there on the line.
In this new book, are any of the characters actual historical figures? I'm thinking of Eight Men Out, which is mm-hmm. based on real people. I don't know if any of your other movies included real figures.
Yeah, there's a bunch of them. Mark Twain shows up a couple times. He was the He was the most noted figure, along with Andrew Carnegie, in the anti-imperialist movement. People back in those days didn't have a lot of euphemisms for things, so you were proudly an imperialist, or, you know, one of the biggest newspapers in North Carolina was the North Carolina Caucasian. We can imagine what the staff looked like and who the readers were. So, yeah, Mark Twain shows up. Damon Runyon, who later wrote, you know, Guys and Dolls, lied about his age and got into the originally the Colorado Volunteers, and he shows up in the Philippines in this. His nickname then was Runt. He was underage and undersized, but somehow managed to get into the fight. Several of the Filipino generals show up in it. And then there are people who aren't famous anymore who show up. Joe Kowinski, who was a very well-known boxer in his day, Jewish-American boxer from San Francisco, who later became the guy who kind of in jail trained Jack Johnson on defense and, you know, made him from a really good fighter into a great fighter. He shows up because he toured Alaska at some point. So, yeah, there are a bunch of, you know, real characters who are kind of spread throughout it. Teddy Roosevelt, who's a big factor in that era, I just felt like I just couldn't find a way to write about Teddy Roosevelt without him seeming like the caricature that you always see of him. And people in the day said, this is a living political cartoon. This is not a person. So I dealt with that there's a vaudevillian who you meet early in the thing who's very low on the bill. And he does this great, he looks like Teddy Roosevelt, and he does this great Teddy Roosevelt impression with a spirit gum mustache. And then as Teddy Roosevelt gets more and more famous, he actually decides, well, I'll grow a real mustache and I'll really get some glasses, and he starts to move up the bill. So we keep checking in with Teddy Roosevelt, but only through this other character. And, you know, it's always tricky with historical characters. They tend to kind of come on the stage and they're useful for a while. And then really I try to get them off pretty quickly because the characters I've invented who are composites can do many more things because we don't know what they did. Yes, on the aisle.
When you decide you have a story you want to tell, how do you decide if you want to do it as a film or as a novel?
You know, this one I should have decided right away it's a novel because I wrote it as a screenplay first. And then after scouting and thinking about it, we realized nobody's ever going to give us the money to make this very ambitious thing. It sat for several years, and then I decided, you know, I had always felt like I was cramming too much into 2 hours when I wrote the screenplay. You know, what if I made it into a novel? It could expand. And I added another 30 characters, major characters, and it expanded. So, you know, sometimes it's not clear, and sometimes you start out in one direction and the other. Some of it's about scale. If you're a low-budget filmmaker like we are, you know, I always say in Los Gusanos, I was able to do the Bay of Pigs invasion in 6 pages, and I didn't have to pay for the boots. You know, I could have, you know, the sun shining, there's tanks, there's airplanes, there's 3,000 guys marching down the road, and they're all wearing boots. Whereas if you make that movie, the costumer comes to you the first day and says, are we going to see their feet? You know, and you got to think about that. So, you know, you get to be God in a novel, and that's some of it if you're going to do something on a big scale. Also, there is this thing in movies that, you know, in a book, if you're working well, you can get people to feel things, to know things, to realize things, but it's all got to go through your head. In a movie, there's all kinds of stuff that's just visceral. The music, the surprise, the look of the thing that doesn't go through your head. And there are some stories that I feel like, you know, I could describe that, but it's just not going to be the same as putting the audience there and seeing it. You know, so sometimes that's really it. There's something visceral about the movie that I think is an important part of it. Our last feature, Honey Dripper, is about music. you know? And yeah, you could write the novel and put a sleeve on it and put the CD in there, but it's much better to see the music and feel the, you know, and all the music in the movie is live. When people are playing on a stage, it's them really playing. There's just something about that that's visceral and immediate. Somebody in the back? Way back. You got a mic?
I wondered about your process for actually writing the book. I know it's like 1,000 pages, and you hadn't written the book for a really long
900,
time.
900, please.
Okay. I just wondered how you sat, what the process was for you to write, since you hadn't really been writing on any scale for so long.
You know, very, very much like my last novel, Los Gusanos, I had the idea for it. I wrote, you know, a couple kind of outline-y type things that I knew would evolve over time. I wrote one or two chapters, and then I got busy. I make a living as a screenwriter for hire. I made another movie. I had to, you know, do the publicity for that movie. So it just sat for several years in this really kind of embryonic form. And then about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, I had a period of unemployment followed by a Writers Guild of America strike, a good, healthy 6-month strike. And Los Gusanos actually came out after a Writers Guild strike. So I couldn't write screenplays for anybody but myself. And I probably wrote 90% of the book then. In about a year period, I have a rule with myself that I can only do 1 week of research, and then I have to sit down and actually write some fiction, because research is fun and seductive, and you can just get lost in it, and it can lead you away to a whole nother story. So I would look at a chapter, say, what don't I know that I need to know, and then do just the research for that chapter, and it could be, you know, really varied stuff, and then I sit down and write a chapter. So every once in a while, I would write a chapter and I would say, well, I know this comes after everything I've already written, but this may not be exactly where it comes in the book because the book is getting big. Once I added the other three major characters who didn't exist in the screenplay, I kind of figured out an arc for them. It wasn't exact, but an arc that they should follow. And then, you know, it sounds a bit of a cliche to say it, but then stuff just starts to happen, and you realize, oh, he's got to go here, and oh, this connects with that, and oh, what if he does this? And they do take on a life of their own, and they lead you places that you didn't know. And then sometimes you have to say, whoa, 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 you know, and herd them back into the book. And then if you have 960 pages, you don't have to herd them that much. They can go a lot of places as long as that arc stays. And then one thing that I did that I have never had to do before, there are four major characters who have at least 150, 200 pages written in their point of view about their particular experience in this. When I finished the first draft, I took those out and made them into separate books in the chronology. So there's the Book of Hod that starts with this chapter. There's the Book of Diosdado, who's a Filipino character. There's the Book of Royal Scott, who is an African-American character who's in the 24th Infantry. And there's the Book of this guy, Harry Manigault, who is a Southerner who comes up and gets involved with Edison in the earliest movies. And I read those as separate books to make sure that the style of writing and their vocabulary and their rhythm of speaking was consistent, as if the book was going to only be about them. And then once I got that consistent and I felt like the arc was there, I put those chapters back into the book. So there, once it gets this big, you do have to kind of think about, Do I remember how I spelled the guy's name and go back to page, you know, 30? That happened to Faulkner in his later years. He had some running characters, and he was too lazy to go to the bookshelf and look up how he spelled somebody's name. And it migrated somewhere. Yes?
You spoke about the seduction of the research process. Where do you go to research when you're reading things as diverse as diaries and other kinds of true accounts?
You know, I don't think I could have done this if it was just library work. I think that the internet really, I read very little on the internet, but I was able to track down books, and one book leads to another. The main thing with this kind of history is, you know, I eventually scored copies of things that were written at the time in 1898, 1900, whatever. They are incredibly, you know, from our point of view, biased and racist. And the biases may be different, but they're incredibly biased and racist. I read Spanish, so a lot of the Filipino, you know, ilustrados, the educated people were writing in Spanish. That helped. I read novels. I read handbooks on, you know, the linotype machine or how to harness a horse or whatever, very specific things, the Krag rifle. I read a lot of newspapers from the time. What you find is just like on Wikipedia or your IMDb or any form of, you know, email kind of stuff. Misinformation gets repeated as much as information. So when you hear a story, you try to look at, you know, where did they get their story? And you go back. And so I finally went to the source materials. And every once in a while I said, oh, they're all taking this incident from this guy. And he wasn't even there. You know, he just made this stuff up, you know, or he was a really biased guy and I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw him. And then you find people that you actually do trust a little bit more and incidents that you do trust. I found a lot of diaries. There was the Philippine-American War is where we learned the technique of waterboarding. It was called the water cure back then. The Spanish had been using it against the Filipinos, and we picked it up very quickly. And there, because this war was very controversial in its time, there were congressional hearings, much like the church committee after Vietnam, and a lot of testimony I was able to read from soldiers. And in that testimony, they included a lot of letters home from soldiers who were, you know, some of them were gung-ho, some of them thought it was great to be killing Filipinos, and some of them were feeling like, wait a minute, I signed up to free the poor Cuban people from the dirty Dago exploiters and, you know, oppressors, and what am I doing in the Philippines killing Filipinos? This is the exact opposite of what we're supposed to be doing. So you get an aggregate of those things, and you start to say, okay, well, what happened is very different depending on who you're talking to. They have a totally different idea of what happened. So in a book like A Moment in the Sun, it's a mosaic way of telling a story, and the reader gets to connect the dots. And the reader gets to know more than any one character because they get to speak every language. They get to access all these different points of view. So there's not much authorial comment in what I do, but there's a lot of, okay, who am I going to put on stage now? And I feel like I've accessed the way they see the world. So, it's probably 150, 200 books that some of them I read the whole thing and some I just skimmed because who wants to know that much about linotype operating? And, you know. Okay, one more question. And do I have a new movie coming out, she says? In August, we have a movie that we made in the Philippines that's set during the same time, during the Philippine-American War, called Amigo. None of the same characters as in the book, but, you know, kind of one of the situations, which is a little Filipino village that's been garrisoned by Americans. And the Amigo of the title is the mayor of the village, who very much like people who were mayors of French villages during the Nazi occupation or mayors of Vietnamese villages when we were there or Algerian villages when the French were in Algeria, have to deal with the soldiers who have literally taken over their home and made it headquarters and their relatives who are in the underground or the guerrilla movement still fighting against the occupiers. And in the Philippine situation, hundreds if not thousands of these guys were killed by one side or the other. So it's about a guy who's between a rock and a hard place. And that's going to open mostly in cities that have a large Philippine-American population and then hopefully spread out from there in August here. It's opening in the Philippines if you have any relatives there on July 4th, the former Philippine-American Friendship Day. And Chris Cooper and a bunch of really great Filipino actors are in it. So I'm going to be available, I think, to sign books out in the lobby upstairs. And thanks for coming, everybody. It was great.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.